Bank is funded by listeners like you.
Today on Geek Tank, we talk about Tim Burton and the cult of Tim Burton.
Tropes surrounding Tim Burton and our favorite memories connected to his films.
And we get really, really awkwardly obsessive with pigeons and holes.
More after this.
Hi, I'm Troy.
Hi, I'm Chelsea.
And this is Geek Tank,
your Frankenweiner-sized podcast.
This week, we're out of our depth.
We're talking about Tim Burton today on our show, but first, the news. In news, Discovery broke a franchise record by dropping the F-bomb in the episode Choose Your Pain, slinging mud, and that means Harry Mud, who is introduced in the episode. And producer Aaron Halbert announced on Twitter that the filming of season one was wrapped on October 11th. Next week's episode is Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad. The Orville had the biggest drama debut in 2 years for Fox. It returns next week with Majority Rules. And sad news today from Santa Rosa, California. Charles Schulz's longtime home burned down in the horrible Santa Rosa fires. Luckily, Gene Schulz was evacuated safely. The museum with all of his memorabilia, though, is still standing. But everything that was there when old Sparky was drawing is gone, unfortunately.
If you haven't seen it yet, you need to see the trailer for Star Wars The Last Jedi. The film is coming out on December 15th, and tickets are already selling fast for the premiere. Trailer definitely still isn't giving us a ton of information, but we'll see how this goes from here.
On Saturday, October 28th, from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., my local comic book place, Vision Comics and Oddities, is going to be doing a Halloween carnival and comic fest. There'll be free comics, candy, spooky crafts, cosplay, pizza, killer tunes, costume contest, and fun for all ages, including carnival games, prizes, and treats for kids 12 and under. There's also free prize raffles for those ages 13 and up, and a horror pinball arcade, and 10% off all in-store purchases. Vision Comics and Oddities is located at 3958 South Federal Boulevard, Sheridan, Colorado, 80110, and you can find them on Facebook.
And that's the news. So this show is about Tim Burton.
Because it is October.
It is. It is the season of Tim Burton.
And if people are paying attention, this is our second in the theme of October stuff. Halloween-y stuff.
It's like right? We plan things out or something.
I know. Well, we kind of owed the first episode of October to someone else that wasn't really quite Halloween-y.
Well, right? Yeah, well, it would have been the first and the second, because No Man's Sky, and then we did Jacqueline Carey, and then we did...
Was Monday? Oh, see, I thought Monday was... it's September ran away just last second there.
Yeah, you're having issues.
I am.
There's five of these.
No Man's Sky, some people hated it and thought it was horrific, so therefore it could have been a horror game in that way. I'm sure it was horrific for the creators of all the flack that they got for it.
Flack. There you go.
Well, I'm just obsessed with Halloween, so I push themes of Halloween throughout the whole year.
Right.
And this happens to be a month with five Mondays. So
yay!
We got
a bonus episode.
A bonus, because we get three Halloween, October. Anyway, Tim Burton.
That dude.
People.
Crazy hair guy.
It is a season where everybody seems to bust out with all their favorite Tim Burton films. And the thing that seems to take the head on this is The Nightmare Before Christmas.
I love The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Everybody watches it for Halloween and for Christmas.
And Christmas, yeah. It hits twice.
Yeah, so you get the double whammy.
Double whammy. The whammy of double. But yeah, I mean, one of the things that, I mean, I like it for a reason that probably is not unique per se, but not the most common reason, because of course it's a stop motion movie, which is rare and uncommon. And I love that. I mean, it's stop motion animation is really hard and really difficult. And it's actually that infamous story that I keep telling whenever I talk about my career as an animator when I was in college. And that was what I was doing. I was doing stop motion animation when I worked all night long, and we didn't realize that I was actually, we didn't realize that the sun had risen.
Yep, and this is back before you could just fake it with computer graphics.
Yeah.
It really is a labor of love.
It is. It absolutely totally is.
And for Nightmare, they're singing, so it's even more of a labor of love because there's so much more to add.
Right. To Nightmare piece. Before Christmas and Corpse Bride, there's so much to see in those scenes, and there's so much to observe, and they're so wonderful to watch. I remember seeing a behind the scenes with Nightmare where they were showing all the heads.
Yes,
for Jack Skellington, so that he could do all of his little mouths, so he could move his mouth, so he could do all of his talking and singing. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so cool to see. So I didn't actually mean to go on about this. It's like, almost like we worship him. It's like cultish, this cult of Tim Burton. Well, which leads us to the first segment, which is the cult of Tim Burton.
And the cult of Tim Burton meaning people who are just basically geeks. They geek out over Tim Burton. Fans of Tim Burton.
I absolutely love Tim Burton, and I have since I was a kid. When I was very, very little, my dad first showed me the short Vincent, which is about a man who wants to be Vincent Price.
Right.
And it's a very cute little short, and it was usually paired with Frank and Winnie, which are some of his first stop motion shorts, and they were very, very cute, and I love them to death. And then seeing Nightmare and seeing Batman and seeing Beetlejuice, I just fell in love with the world of this gothic horror kind of meets sunny suburbia.
Yeah.
It's just this clash of two cultures, you know.
What's funny is I sometimes forget that Pee Wee Herman's Big Adventure was a Tim Burton film, because there's no gothicness in it other than the one scene with Large Marge where it's the clay animation,
so scary
face, which that just screams Tim Burton at that point.
That movie scared me so bad I can't watch it again. Like
you can't even just skip that part?
My chest still clenches. That scared me so bad, and I don't know what it is about Pee Wee Herman. I can't. He creeps me out so bad. And he's supposed to be for kids, right?
Like, I think Pee Wee Herman pretty much creeps out a lot of people. you know.
Pee Wee Herman's
people
one of those
movie theaters
outcasts.
Get creeped out about.
You know, it was a very specific movie theater, and I would have totally expected the type of behavior happening there. Now, had he been seeing a kids' movie in a movie theater and done what he did, I would be a lot more upset with him.
Yeah, that would probably be little bit more creepy.
I mean, I'm not necessarily condoning it. I'm just saying that it makes kind of sense.
It was logical.
Yeah. but it was Beetlejuice really is the one I think of first when I think of Tim Burton, because of it really capturing that essence of the humor and the horror.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kind of smashed together.
And Danny Elfman, who I love, who seems to always, he goes like he's the peanut butter to Tim Burton's chocolate and the Reese's Cup combo. What they are.
Absolutely. Like, you do not have Tim Burton.
And for those who don't know who Danny Elfman is, he was the lead person in Oingo Boingo.
Oingo Boingo. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Dead Man's Party is one of
the
best.
Which is the one everyone remembers because that's the one they always play on the radio.
I still have it on tape in my car.
Is it the same tape
right now? Yeah, it's the same tape.
From like the 80s?
From the 80s, yeah. Yeah, it's the same one. It's an actual tape. It's a cassette tape.
From the 80s.
From the 80s.
It even says, I'm from the 80s.
It screams it practically.
It starts with, you know, Y-108. Denver's Y-108.
It seemed like in the past 5 years, there's like a resurgence of the Nightmare Before Christmas merchandise.
Oh, yeah. That's because Hot Topic finally has licensing for it. Because
is that what it was?
It falls under the Disney hat. From what I know of Tim Burton, he started as a Disney animator and was able to make his own kind of stuff later once he branched out. So Disney did get the rights. And that's a big thing during Christmas and Halloween is they sell a lot of merchandise Hot Topic is kind of like it used to be the hit goth store, right?
Yeah.
It used to be the goth punk kind of style that you could go in and find your favorite kind of underground bands and all their gear and some gothic makeup and accoutrements, so to say. Now it's a lot more pop culture-y, but it started its roots in the gothic world, and I think it's kind of still holding on to that with the Tim Burton merchandise, and they can certainly profit off of it because all of us love it. Jack and Sally is probably the most idealized couple from the Tim Burton repertoire. They're the most beloved.
Right.
And they are very cute.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree with, like, the mass merchandise, but they are very cute, to say the least.
They're adrabble. So is anything bother you about the cult of Tim Burton?
Not particularly. My biggest thing is that it's not a year-round thing. I really like to just kind of dig into Tim Burton films when I'm feeling very lonely and very introverted, when I feel like I'm not part of the world, when I feel gross and ugly inside and like I'm a horrible person and I'm an outcast and I'll never fit in. That's when I dig into a Tim Burton film.
Which is kind of like the life of a geek.
It definitely is. It's just trying to find your place and not necessarily to blend in with the crowd. You can still stay unique. That's a big theme in Tim Burton's films, is you can still be unique and let your freak flag fly. But people will accept you as long as you are willing to accept them as well. It's on both sides, which is really kind of sweet.
Hmm.
So that's kind of what I really enjoy. I wish it was kind of a year-round thing, the love for Tim Burton, but it seems to really pop up during Halloween because of the gothic horror elements. And the films are, they tend to be a little bit darker. There are some horror elements to them. When I was watching Nightmare Before Christmas last week, it popped on and I was super, super excited. I was looking at some of the monsters in Halloween Town and I was like, these guys are genuinely scary, but I never felt like they were scary when I watched this as a kid, and it was because of how Tim Burton portrayed them. You know, they talk about this is our town, but we're not mean in our town of Halloween.
For me as an audience member, it always portrayed itself as welcoming and makes you feel like you're part of that town watching it.
Mm-hmm. Even though these things are scary or necessarily not normal.
Which in and of itself is kind of an interesting statement, because people sometimes look scary. But they really aren't.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, he's making an interesting commentary.
It's the ones that don't look scary that you have to watch out for.
Yep. They look like ordinary people.
So, I've lost my place.
He lost his place.
Oh, I remember. Oh. You were mentioning this, the hidden scary. I was going to show Beetlejuice to my son. Mm-hmm. And upon rewatching it, this was back when he was a little younger, I realized I don't know if I want him to watch something that actually has suicide as a theme in it like that, which I had forgotten about because it's only part of it, and it's not what the movie's really necessarily about, but it is, when you're watching it, when I was trying to watch it with fresh eyes since I was imagining what my son would see, I was like, this is actually really disturbing.
Yeah.
I watched it, though, when I was very young. I watched it when I was 8 or 9, and I kind of saw it as a cooperating with death film and teaching others about death in particular, because a couple is struggling so much, and I had no concept of death. My grandparents are still very well alive. I've only lost one, and that was only 2 years ago. So for me, I hadn't, you know, really come face to face with it per se. But it kind of helped me to understand the difficulties of what happens when somebody passes, because you're thinking about the house and you're thinking about where things go and what impact it has on those people. And it kind of makes you wonder, as always, you know, when you're late at night staying in bed wide awake or in the shower having those shower thoughts, like what's going to happen to you when you die? Are you going to be confused and disoriented? Are you going to have a guide? Or are they just going to give you a handbook and expect you to figure it out? Which lends some comedy to it a little bit.
It does. I mean, and now that you mention that kind of thing and you're talking about Beetlejuice, there are some visuals in that that are kind of creepy, too.
Well, especially when the mother, they're trying to figure out how to be creepy and scary. She, like, pulls her head back, pops her eyes out.
Yeah, I was thinking that, too. That's exactly the same scene
I was thinking about. It might be too much nightmare fuel for a younger kid.
Yeah.
Tim Burton has some social commentary. I mean, you see in Edward Scissorhands, you know, they take advantage of him. They put him in a salon, but he's happier trimming bushes. He finds his way to fit into society, but they're trying to make him blend in. He still figures it out on his own and follows his own path, thankfully. But you see people, like, trying to be helpful but also being hurtful in that process. You know what I mean? Because it ends up damaging him a little bit. So Tim likes to point out the idiosyncrasies of trying to get somebody to fit into your mold who's different from you and not learning to just kind of study them and accept them for who they are and see what their oddities are and why they are there. And so that kind of that helps me feel more comfortable as a human being because, you know, sometimes we have those days where like, who the hell am I and what am I doing here?
Right.
And like Sweeney Todd where it tries to point out you should just accept cannibalism, right?
No.
Oh, okay. No. See, I was trying to bring that cannibalism thing back around from last week.
Not being a monster.
Didn't we do that last week?
We did, but...
The one thing I do want to point out in Sweeney Todd is Joanna, the little innocent girl who's been trapped in a room. She's the little caged bird the whole time, right? So Anthony is like, she asks him what they're going to do. Like, are they going to run away? And he's like, yeah, all our dreams will come true. And she's like... No, our nightmares never really go away and dreams don't always come true. That's a hard hitter that people often miss, but he really punches you in the gut with that. It's just that nice little finish to that film. He always has something extra to kind of add in that was maybe in the original piece that he's interpreting or that maybe you wouldn't think of necessarily, but he really makes it count, you know. It's the same way with, like, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. He brought in the dad as a dentist, which kind of makes Willy Wonka's childhood a little bit...
Kind of explains
drilly.
It.
Yeah.
His love for sugar and
it
candy.
Makes it... It's a tragic love ode. I mean, he built this entire factory and shut his dad out, and they go to visit his dad, and it's that very awkward moment, but his teeth are still perfect. Like, just a little rekindling moment that's awkward as heck. But it's very, very sweet. He knows how to find those little niches and really make things count.
Yep.
Which is awesome.
So you know what else we can count on? A break.
Ooh.
So we'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm Bitsy Tulloch. I play both Juliet Silverton and Eve on Grimm. You are listening to Geek Tank.
So this is our Ask Us Anything segment of the show. And our question today comes from the ether. And the question is, what is your most disappointing episode of a beloved TV show? And I will pass this one to Troy to start.
So I thought this was an interesting question in that I had a really hard time thinking of a TV show that I'm so in love with that it could disappoint me. Because there's so many episodes in a TV show, I give it a lot more leeway than I would like a movie series, Phantom Menace. And so it was tricky to come up with one on that. And the one that I came up with, because is one where, what TV show do I think dropped the ball so horribly with just one episode? And for me, that would be Lost. Because it really let me down. They lost it. They really dropped the ball for me on that very last episode, and that they could have ended it very differently. So that was a single episode of a show that was super disappointing to me.
Did that ruin the rest of the show for you? Or did you just like not even...
I can watch the show, but I stopped 10 minutes before the end of the last episode and it's a good show in my mind.
Okay.
If I just disregard what they came up with and write my own ending in my mind. Because there's a lot of good stuff, a lot of good acting, and a lot of really interesting stuff in the show. So the show's not bad because of that, but that one episode was disappointing to me.
So you just write it off? You're just like, I'm done.
I write it
at
off.
10 minutes towards the end?
Kind of like the way some people write off the How I Met Your Mother episode. What you use ready for next one?
Well, it's going to be, because Beloved for me always means Star Trek.
Of course.
Yes.
But there's like a billion Star Treks. So.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
But it's, for me, it's pretty much, well, It's straight up. It's the last episode of Enterprise.
Oh.
Which, Enterprise was a rough ride to begin with.
It was such a rough ride.
But that last episode was really bad.
And everything I've heard about it has convinced me not to watch it. And
A train wreck. And it was. Not only was it a train wreck, it was a cannon smashing, like, ruin the whole thing. And to boot, it was touted as a Valentine to the fans, which made it even more
black smear.
Even more of a smack you in the nose, sort of. Oh, it was horrible. It was kind of like Into Darkness was, no, you'll all love this. No, really. It's just horrible. Sometimes they really just, it's horrible. Anyway, so yeah, the last episode of Enterprise. If you're going to watch Enterprise, just...
Well, you can skip the last 10 minutes, right?
No.
The whole episode?
Just write the whole episode off.
All right. Write the whole episode off. Stop.
There's
at Terra Nova and you're good. And just don't even bother. Don't even bother. It's fine. Because season 4 of Enterprise is beautiful. It's a gorgeous season. I mean, Cold Front's kind of weird, but the rest of season 4 is like the best of Enterprise, except for that last episode.
I'm going to try and go back and watch that series, but we'll see if I make it through very far.
Yeah. These Are the Voyages is really just, no.
No.
It's bad. It's bad.
Abandon ship.
Yeah, just don't watch it.
All right, Chelsea, your turn.
Oh, man. So a couple years ago, I started watching Sci-Fi's Lost Girl, and it's actually a pretty well-written show for the Sci-Fi channel, which I've called lately the Syphilis Channel because they've just been turning out crappy B-movies and spin-off shows that nobody wanted. And I was really invested in the show, and there was definitely a conflict with the main character being a succubus, and she's kind of stuck between these two characters, like, which one should I date and which way should I go?
She was a succubus.
She had this stunning doctor that she could kind of go for that she'd kind of flirted with before, and then she had her male counterpart who she'd really kind of gone after, and it seemed like they had a really good repertoire. Well, the writers decided that she should just not have to choose at all and go with both, and thus started the most awkward love triangle I've ever seen on television, and it was awful. It wasn't well written. It wasn't well done. It was like, we can't decide either, so she gets both, and it causes really awkward tension, and it's not... Oh, why did you do that? Why? Why?
Maybe they're trying to get the Bachelorette crowd or something.
No. It was
you get a rose
no
and you
reason.
Get a rose.
You know what I mean? And Lost Girl is one of those shows where American television ruined it as usual. You know, American television really doesn't embrace like the mini series. They don't just let a story be done.
Yeah.
People have to obsess about it and get it extended, and then they get a really crappy season. They're like, why did we get it extended? Be grateful, Firefly fans. You got a good run. Leave it. So it was just awful. And I hate it, and I can't watch the rest of the show. And there's like two more seasons, and I was just like, bye, abandon ship, no more. I'm good. I don't have to see season 2 like at all. And they pulled a bunch of BS, and there's no reason for that. Like, just stick to good writing and keep the story fresh and fun. Don't resort to BS tactics to keep people on.
So there you have it, the episode with the succubus who gets stuck in purgatory, and it turns out to all be a hologram.
Yep. And that's our Ask Us Anything. If you have a question for us, you can email it to us at questions@RockyMountainGeekTank.com.
Give me a break. Give me a break. Break me off a piece of that Geek Tank bar. So we're back from break now. We're talking about candies and Tim Burton.
I'm hungry.
Fine. Here's some pie.
Meat pie.
Have this meat pie, Chelsea.
I don't want meat pie. I would like a chocolate pie, please. Minus the people.
Dang it.
No Augustus Gloop mixed
in. You got people in my pie. You got pie in my people.
That's gross.
So we're going to talk about tropes of Tim Burton.
And there's some pretty obvious ones to start.
And I kind of mentioned how it seems every time there's a movie, you can count on Danny Elfman doing the soundtrack for a Tim Burton movie.
Definitely.
Which I'm not complaining about.
I would never, ever complain about that.
Elfman does some amazing things, but what's interesting is that there are things that I never thought about specifically going with Elfman. One of the things that gets me is that the most memorable Batman theme is Elfman's theme.
Yes.
Yes.
Even though that isn't necessarily related to the Burton thing directly, it is still one of the things that when you think of Batman, I pull up the Batman theme in my head that Elfman composed. And I mean, it's up there with, you know, John Williams' Superman theme. And I'm like, wow, you know, you think that's pretty impressive.
That whole soundtrack to Batman is absolutely fantastic. It's lovely and sweet and creepy at the same time. It just, it fills all those little Halloween niches that you need in life.
And there's, I will point
superhero-y.
Out, there's two separate soundtracks to the Batman movie because I haven't had them both. I don't know if I still have them because Prince did the Batman song.
Yes,
so there's like,
he did some music for it.
So there's
too.
One soundtrack that's all the music that you would hear from like Prince and then the other stuff they did, and then you have the Elfman soundtrack, the original soundtrack score.
But they work really, really well together.
Yes.
That's really nice to have such an iconic artist like Prince and then Danny Elfman working together on two separate sides of the musical chair.
Right.
And they really do mesh.
Yeah, so, strangely, and you wouldn't think they would, but they do.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple other people that we haven't mentioned yet, obviously. Johnny Depp.
Right.
Depp.
And I like Johnny Depp. I wish he would kind of venture a little more outside his comfort zone.
Well, see, I think you see some of his most diverse work when you go back, because if you look at his character, Edward Scissorhands, that's not Depp. That's him acting.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I kind of feel like, to a degree, like Jack Sparrow has more Depp in him than... Or you see more of Depp's actual personality come through in that.
So you're saying he had more Depp of character?
Right.
Oh. The biggest thing is that he's always playing the outsider. And he's very good at it. It seems like, and a lot of people say this, it seems like Johnny Depp is Tim Burton's on-screen...
alter ego.
Yeah, exactly.
His avatar.
His avatar.
And it does work, and Depp does do some interesting things. I think I'm just tired of seeing Depp personally. Like, you see Tim Burton's.
Does your boyfriend know that you're seeing Depp personally?
No.
We're just saying.
And it's the same with Helena Bonham Carter. She does a lot of good stuff, but I feel like she does her best work away from Tim Burton. Like, when she played the Queen in The King's Speech, she was magnificent. It was just exquisite work. Whereas with Tim Burton, she gets to play a little bit more, and she gets to play these wacky characters. I just feel like I like her a little bit more when she's away from Burton personally.
Well, and I think that's the same with Depp. I mean, his breakout role is in the Pirates of the Caribbean. You know, I mean, that's where he's really departing, and that's a very different character than what he plays when he's in Burton.
But he's been stuck with that character for how many films now? Five?
Well, yeah, but
Jesus.
William Shatner's stuck with Kirk, too. I mean, the thing is that when you have a breakout role, you're stuck with it.
Mm-hmm.
You break out, but you're stuck with it. And that's just the way it goes. But still, that's not... I mean, you look at Jack Sparrow, and it's not Edward Scissorhands.
Mm-hmm.
There's no connection at all between those two characters. But you look at Edward Scissorhands and any of the other pieces where Depp has come in to fill the niche in a Tim Burton film, and they're all pretty much the same critter.
Yeah.
But all of the Depp things in Tim Burton films versus Jack Sparrow are completely different. So I think you're getting the same kind of thing.
Well,
as soon as they walk away, you know, in other words, Burton has a job that he's looking for. When he brings in Helen Bonham Carter and when he brings in Johnny Depp.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear that when they break away, you get something totally different.
You do, which is really, really nice. And I'm very, very grateful for that with both of them.
Yeah.
The big thing that I'm surprised that he's never cast as like one specific person is that beautiful, pale, innocent, blonde ingenue. he always has the girl who is very innocent and very withdrawn, who might become a little more powerful, or she becomes a love interest, like in Edward Scissorhands, like in Sleepy Hollow, like in Alice in Wonderland. They always have those long flowing gold locks. They're pale as the night is long, and they are very, very innocent to start. And they might have a little bit of spunk in them, because Burton women always do have some spunk, and they definitely gain more, like Selena Kyle and Catwoman.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Gain some spunk. But he does create these more powerful women as they go. There are a lot of powerful women as well. But that blonde ingenue, I'm surprised he's never like cast one woman to do that. I'm honestly very, very surprised.
Well, it's probably because she would get older.
Yeah. Definitely.
And I think what he's really after, because looking at it from a graphics point of view, from an artistic point of view,
mm-hmm.
everything he does is close to monochrome,
yeah.
is close to, and dark, specifically dark,
mm-hmm.
blacks, dark grays. He really heads for darks, except for his ingenue.
She is bright and white and beautiful.
Bright and white and pale and... Mm-hmm. light hair, and
I almost think that Michelle Pfeiffer's character in Catwoman before she became Catwoman kind of fits that.
Absolutely, it does, because she's the innocent girl,
right?
Who's just trying to make her way in the world,
completely inexperienced until she falls, gets
40
stories and gets licked on by cats, which somehow bestows
cat licking
magical acrobatical skills.
Yeah, cat licking is bad. Abuse.
Absolutely.
Anybody who has cats knows.
Well, that's when you cross the feline.
Yep.
Oh. The puns.
Anyway,
So you have these women who might start off as a beautiful ingenue, and they either become the love interest who is frail and needing of saving, or they become these big, wonderful, fantastic, well-rounded characters who can stick up for themselves. He does like a powerful woman, which is fantastic for me personally. I'm guessing for you both as well. So you have like Alice and Lydia, you have Sally, Catwoman, and you have Emily from Corpse Bride. They really come out of their shell, and they kick butt. They get stuff done, which is fantastic. The architecture can range anywhere from very, very modern and very, very crowded, or very Edwardian with a modern twist.
Yeah.
He likes to keep a mix of kind of that 1900s Edwardian with the modern
right.
edge, or vice versa.
You also see this, a lot of the films will have this stark contrast, so you'll have two polar opposites. So like in Edward Scissorhands, the way the suburbia was just these insanely bright Technicolor colors, mm-hmm. like watching Star Trek, the original series.
With all the different colored houses, pink and yellow and green and blue, and then the house on the hill.
Vincent Price's castle,
beautiful,
yes.
Beautiful Gothic architecture. It's fantastic. I really, really like that contrast. Somehow it magically just fits together. Mm-hmm. Like
it makes it like a storybook.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives everything that he does very storybook attitude.
Oh, yeah. And his costumes are impeccably made. They are perfectly fitted. Nothing's out of place. He likes a lot of stripes. He likes a lot of striking things.
Yeah.
So
well, the stripes fit the same contrast
mm-hmm.
thing with him. I mean, it's clear. I mean, if you think about just Beetlejuice in general,
mm-hmm.
the horizontal striped suit of Beetlejuice. I mean,
you have that fight between kind of the Gothic, you know, mentality and the cheery demeanor, and the fight between those two, which is very sweet. And then somebody pointed out to me the parents in his films are always very loving, I would say, except for Corpse Bride. In Corpse Bride, they're very ridiculous. But like in Beetlejuice, the two parents who die, they are very loving and they're very nurturing. The two parents of Lydia in Beetlejuice, they want the best for her, but they have no idea how to do it.
Right,
but
they're just
still
clueless.
Encouraging. Mm-hmm.
Right, they're just clueless.
Which is sweet. You've got the entire family in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, or Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, I'm sorry. I keep confusing the two dang titles. But the whole family is supportive of Charlie, and they're very, very mm-hmm. sweet and very, very comforting.
Yeah, I believe the book was originally Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and that's why they went to that title.
Well, and the focus was on Willy Wonka.
It was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
The Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory
is the Tim Burton version.
Tim Burton version, okay.
Well, and he's focusing more on the Willy Wonka character.
Right, but and I think that that's why that we get well. Confused.
No, Tim Burton's was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. They were the first one with Gene Wilder was Willy Wonka.
See, this is what happens when you change titles of movies
you
with one
character. You mess with our brain.
Burton went back to the book version and had less songs.
Mm-hmm. And Oompa Loompas.
He CGI'd the Oompa Loompas. It was one Oompa Loompa. To rule them all.
Deep Roy.
One Oompa Loompa
to guide
them.
He was a cool dude, by the way.
Sure.
I met him at Starfest. He's pretty awesome. But you have all these nice little key elements that are always there.
You see in a Burton film, you tend to know it's a Burton film.
Yeah. I will say, it seems like in the more he works with music, the more he likes it. He likes to throw in his characters singing here and there, even if it doesn't necessarily fit. Like, I feel like Corpse Bride was, like, half sing-songy, but not fully. And he kind of tried to bridge a gap between, like, Edward Scissorhands and Nightmare Before Christmas with Corpse Bride, kind of meshing two different kind of tropes with it. And it did work, but it didn't feel like a full musical, and it didn't feel like a full, like, normal film.
I never saw the 2014 Big Eyes, which was kind of a pseudo-documentary. It wasn't done in documentary style, but it was about the artist Margaret Keane. I heard about that, but I haven't seen it. Right, and I think that was where she did the paintings, but her husband tried to take credit for him.
Right.
I'm guessing that probably isn't as recognizable as a Burton film, but I don't know. I haven't seen it. This is the subject matter seems very different than his usual stuff.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Well, the artist's integrity and credibility. That definitely seems like him. He's very
well. It's like him, but I doubt he worked at the tropes of the stripes and the gothic stuff. And I'm pretty sure there was no Johnny Depp or Michael Keaton or.
Sometimes artists just have to take a break and do something completely different.
Well, you got to get out of your pigeonhole. Originally,
did you say that? Never mind.
I said get it out of your pigeonhole, guy.
Ooh. Yeah, but just get it out of your own pigeonhole.
All right, so we're going to go to break while I explore some pigeonholes and make sure that they're empty.
I'm going to stay over here.
We'll be back after this.
Hey, guys. My name is Chaz Kemp. I am a local artist and illustrator. You can find me at www.chazkemp.com. You can also find me at patreon.com.
And we're back with our favorite gothic horror man, Tim Burton.
And we're at our favorite Starbucks at First and Wandsworth, talking about this whole Tim Burton thing.
So, hey, you two. What's your favorite memory you have associated to a Tim Burton movie?
That's a good question. I pass this to you, Chelsea.
Oh, you're going to send it to me first.
She giggles. That doesn't sound good.
But the problem is, I have so many great memories.
Well,
so I'll do a Beetlejuice.
You can make this worse
one.
By saying pick your favorite one.
Yeah,
because that's even
because that helps so
that
freaking
helps
much.
Thanks, guy.
Beetlejuice is amazing. So I don't know if you guys know this, but girls have this thing where when you're young and in middle school and fantasizing about boys and cute stuff. Some of us make books that plan, like, our perfect wedding. And I know that sounds really weird and creepy. It's just kind of one of those things.
I've heard that before, but through television shows.
Normal, I guess. I don't know. But my big thing is, like, everybody was planning, like, a big white wedding. And I was like, I'm going to plan, like, this super cool gothic thing. And we're going to
I was going to say, I was okay with everything up until the Beetlejuice wedding, where you had sandworms.
No sandworms.
Oh, okay.
No creepy dead guy.
I was just going to say, you married to Michael Keaton. You say his name three times. He shows up at the altar.
I would be married to Michael Keaton.
And
I would be okay with that.
Okay.
Be completely fine. I adore Michael Keaton as an actor. He's absolutely fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
But the big thing about Beetlejuice and Tim Burton's wacky sense of humor is it showed that things could be different. Things didn't have to necessarily be the big, normal white wedding thing. It could be a red dress that you could wear for a wedding, or it could be, you know, you could wear black clothes every single day and take photos trying to find dead things, and that would be normal. I really loved Lydia Dietz, essentially. She was kind of one of my heroes growing up because she was different and she was a little weird, but you know, people were really supportive of her. Her parents and her adopted parents, you could say, with the dead couple, they loved her very much. And they made her become a better person, more comfortable in her own skin. And I always wanted to be more comfortable in my own skin, but I'm still not quite there yet. And that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. I think I developed a crush on Winona Ryder because of that movie. Because of that very thing. She was very comfortable in who she was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an attractive trait for me.
Yeah.
In a woman. That was a very attractive trait, is very comfortable in who you are.
Didn't really carry over to the Alien movie, did it?
No.
Her eyes got bigger, I think.
When she was cult. She was very cultish in that movie.
She was a cult of Tim Burton.
She was a cult of Tim Burton. I don't think she was a cult of Tim Burton, though.
So,
But when you were talking about that, a lot of my friends, female friends, were very enamored with that movie. So you weren't alone.
It was it was so fun and so wacky and so different. It made me realize that I could be different and that was okay.
Yeah.
And it kind of led to that whole self-acceptance journey that you go down in middle and high school. And it's still happening. You know, there are some moments where I'm like, why are you so freaking weird? Can you please stop? Because there are some moments where I don't make any sense even to myself. So I just
remember. She thinks that stops. Okay. I mean, really, she thinks that stops and it never does.
I hoped it would, but, you know, you just kind of accept that life will keep punching you to the ground eventually. Oh, no, learn how to get back up.
That stops because you just lay there ultimately.
Oh, no.
Well, it's, you roll up in a ball and pretend that you're dead, and then it stops, right?
It goes
right,
away at some point.
Rise life's from like, the dead?
Hey, we give up on you. So, Troy, what's your favorite?
All right. So, it was. Has to be when Nightmare Before Christmas came out, which I think was 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, it came out in the fall because it was a Christmas movie. And at the time, my now wife, at the time girlfriend in 93, Tara, was going to Ohio Wesleyan, which is in Delaware, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And I was up there visiting her, and there's a little movie theater called the Strand Movie Theater, if I remember correctly, that we went to see it. We had no idea what we were seeing other than it was a claymation musical by Tim Burton. So we, other than that, hadn't seen previews for it yet. And the cool thing about the Strand is it has an upper balcony, so it's one of these really old movie theaters. So it has a character and a flavor to it.
Okay.
And being a really small college town, there was like maybe nobody else in the theater that I can remember. So it was like our own private showing of this film. And when we left, it was snowing really like lightly, like flurry. So it's just the whole moment of having that date night.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that film, which had such a great romantic aspect to it, that memory is associated to that film, would be my closest connection with that.
It sounds so sweet.
It was so cool.
Aww.
So my memory also involves Nightmare Before Christmas. When it came out in 93, I had moved out at this point in time, because I had just moved out, and I'd been on my own for, I don't know, maybe 6 months or maybe 8 months when it came out, and then it was in the movie theater, or was in the movie theaters, then it was in the video stores. And so my mom...
Your mom.
...decided to say, hey, why don't you come over and rent that movie that was animated? And so we rented the movie, and my sister and my mom and I all watched the movie. I don't remember if my sister was there or not. Either way. But I remember my mom and I sat there and just... We watched the movie and really enjoyed it. And we analyzed it. And we kind of went through the technicals of how it was made. And she was really interested because she knew how filmmaking worked because she was a producer.
Mm-hmm.
But she had no idea how stop motion animation worked. So she was asking me, how does the animation work? And it was like the first time that she was asking my expertise in her field.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had evolved out of her field. And it was a sort of a watershed moment where I realized that even though I was in her field, she still didn't understand enough that she needed me to explain to her, how does stop motion animation work? How does all of this work? How is this character talking? If it's a model standing on a stage, how is it talking? Mm-hmm. You know, and stuff like that. Because this was before CGI and before computers could do any of this, really. So in her mind's eye, she couldn't have conceived of the idea of a computer doing it anyway. So even though CGI did exist at the time, it wasn't CGI. So she'd still, and she had comprehension of stop motion, but she had no idea the complexity of it. And so it was a really great bonding experience. And like I said, we had moved out, and I had moved out. My sister had moved out as well. So it was kind of nice to have the moment of all of us back in the house again. And so that was kind of a fun, that's my fun experience with that particular movie. I've always loved that movie for multiple reasons, but it's that one, that's the sort of the technical breakdown of that movie. I love technically breaking that movie down because it's a really great movie for how to do stop motion. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an excellent how-to.
It's a really well-done film. It's a nice blend of so many different elements. It's about finding out who you are and what your place is in the world. And even if your role gets boring, this is how you can change it and how to work with people and find something new.
And about exploring outside of the world you're comfortable with, because Jack Skellington knew he wanted something more than mm-hmm. what his world was providing him.
Yeah.
He had grown complacent, and he realized it, and he went forth and did something about it. And there's a little bit of a love story in there as well that's very, very sweet. And the two holidays coming together, like, I love that Halloween and Christmas were mixed together. I was looking at the doors, and I was like, Thanksgiving, nah. Easter, nah. Valentine's Day, nah. Christmas was perfect. Like, I don't know why they blend so well. It's, again, that, like, that gothic... You know,
well, the original German version had the Krampus, which would, if you were a bad child, it was the, like, for lack of a better thing, an evil version of Santa that would mm-hmm. go around and kidnap kids and stuff. And so it's, well, it has horror elements.
I kind of feel like prior to Nightmare Before Christmas, mm-hmm. 70s, 80s, 60s, 50s, going back into our history, Halloween was sort of a one-off. And sort of this thing, and then we went into the holiday season of Thanksgiving, and everything like that. But Halloween was separate.
Mm-hmm.
Since Nightmare Before Christmas, it sort of brought Halloween in to that entire season. And once we hit Halloween, we're into all the weird holidays. They all have different feels and different shifts, mm-hmm. but we sort of have this one continuous mood. That goes from from
it's
Halloween
super family
through.
Focused and fun.
Right, it like turned it Halloween into Halloween a family fun. Focused mm-hmm. thing.
I still think there should be a law that no advertising for a holiday should happen before 30 days of that holiday.
Tell that to the Hallmark Channel and get it. I am, to do that, because I seriously got on the Hallmark Channel and there was a Christmas movie in mid-September and I lost my mind on. Freaking Instagram.
My problem is you walk in a store and they have Christmas trees up and it's not even November yet.
I know. And I will say, though, they had pumpkins out in September, which is what I really feel like fall is here, when you're like carving pumpkins, when you're making candy apples, when you're starting to get into all those, like, the food crafting. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what really kickstarts it, is autumn. It's cold enough so we can start cooking.
Well, pumpkins can have pumpkin pie and pumpkin spice latte, such as here at Starbucks.
Yeah.
And I wish we got some kind of patronage from these guys. In any case, pumpkins are, I mean, if they had, you know, skulls and gravestones and stuff in September, then that's still kind of jumping the gun. If it's Halloween related, if you're just doing it because people are dead, then that's fine.
I don't feel like that's jumping the gun at all. Because, like, the biggest thing about the Halloween season is all of us kind of nerdy introverts who do love Tim Burton love the Halloween season. Mm-hmm. So we're loving all through September and October this season of just fun and fright and just celebrating, you know, kind of our own individual freakiness.
I think it gives the people who want to do Christmas through November, though, more power.
Don't do it. It's a trap. That's horrible.
Sorry.
Don't do it.
It's
Wait.
All or nothing.
Wait. Jesus was born in April.
And there we go.
Okay, fine.
And so, you know what? That sounds like a basis for a debate, which leads us to our 1-minute debate.
again, it's time for our one-minute debate, where we pick a subject and debate it for 1 minute, and then rebate it 1 minute, and then counterbait it for 1 minute, and then take it back and bait it again for the last 1 minute.
That's a lot
and
of
so it's a lot of baits,
like
and you
Bates
will
hotel.
Master them. And so we're going to go for this time around movies versus video games, and I think we're going to look at possibly which is better at storytelling, which is more entertaining. So Chelsea. Which are you going to take? Are you going to take video games?
Video games.
Of course you are. So your time begins now. Now.
So a typical indie video game usually lasts anywhere from 2 to 10 hours. A typical AAA title lasts about 40 hours plus. And some even have additional content that have additional storytelling. I like to focus on BioWare. They are fantastic. You get 40 solid hours of story. Characters and their backgrounds. You can choose to learn about people or not. They have codex entries that let you learn about the world, so they have this hugely rich environment with hours and hours of content to keep you entertained. With the Dragon Age series, you get a lot of fantasy, a lot of high fantasy content. With Mass Effect, you get a lot of sci-fi content, and so you're just allowed to explore that world at your leisure and get as much story as you want out of the game, which takes so much effort and so much precision that video games, they top it in storytelling. They blast it out of the park.
Pew, 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 pew. Your time is now up. All right, now time for Guy to debate pro movies.
In a movie environment, I feel like you can get concisely to one thread story. So you have just one story that starts with a beginning, a middle, and an end. You can go from development of a character and see how that character grows and how that character lives and maybe even how that character dies. But it's concise, it's very short, and it's a tale that you can tell your children, you can tell other people. It's one solid unit. And because of that, I think that it's a much richer environment. Also, you can be more tactical about how you build the set and the environment, so that you can make it all very exact. The artist can put exactly what they want to show in there.
In a world where your time is up. All right, so now we will go to Chelsea's second portion of debating for video games.
Rebutes it.
So linear stories are boring. I like stories with multiple layers on top of each other. In a movie, you can't get too complicated. You can't create a really diverse environment and really dig into characters' backgrounds and know everything that you possibly can about them. With the video game, since there's so much content, since there's so many hours, you are allowed to explore different facets. And there's usually character missions where you have to do loyalty things, where you're learning about their character and learning about their background. There's also a little bit of romance. You're actively involved in this story. You're making decisions that affect the story in real time. So you get more entertainment and more interaction out of that story. Whereas in a movie, you're sitting in a chair. You can't really affect it per se. You can always give your take on it, but you are not actively helping create your character and create your story, and you don't really get to make a movie yours, whereas a video game, you absolutely do, and you make an effect on the characters and on your environment.
That's your time there as Mario dies. And so now Guy gets the final say.
The difference between the problem with video games, of course, is that there's so much content that you lose the plot. You lose everything. You can get completely lost in the world and lose what you're trying to see. I mean, it's an environment that's so huge that you can't find the end. And so you lose everything about it. Yeah, you don't know where Alice went. She's somewhere in Wonderland. And so the thing about a movie is that you can stay with the characters. You can stay with the individual throughout the entire story. Whereas a video game, who knows where it went? And you may have lost some critical piece to the entire story, but it's gone because it was somewhere else in the huge 40 hours of this game. So that's my rebuttal.
Rawr. That's DMGM Lion, by the way. Well, there you go. There's the arguments, and you can write in and tell us who you think won. Was it Chelsea or was it Guy? And you can write us at
questions@RockyMountainGeekTank.com.
If you'd like to send us in your suggestion for one-minute debates you'd like to hear us debate about, you can also write to us at the same place.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been Guy.
I've been Troy.
And I've been Chelsea.
And this is Geek Tank 304.
Stay spooky. As always, you can email us at questions at RockyMountainGeekTank.com. Join the conversation on Twitter at RMGeekTank. You can also follow us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Tumblr for Rocky Mountain Geek Tank. Feel free to join the conversation. We look forward to hearing from you.
Geek Tank is a production of Fox Blade Media and is protected under the Creative Commons 3.0 license.
Your hosts today were Guy S. Davis, C. Troy Floor, and Chelsea Kramer.
Kevin Weibler is our engineer, and our music was composed by David Coyle. Geek Tank is funded by listeners like you. Please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/Foxblade. I'm Mike Davis, and I see dead people. Good night.